Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented free by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. You're about to hear British writer Will Self discuss Psychogeography, Disentangling the Modern Conundrum of Psyche and Place, with David L. Ulan, editor of the LA Times Book Review. Evoking places as far-flung as Iowa and India, Self, cultural provocateur, writer, and long-distance walker, explores the intimate effects of geographical environment on human emotion and behavior. This program was originally produced on November 1st, 2007. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
At U.S. Immigration, JFK Airport, New York. My British passport is scanned. The official scrutinizes the computer screen with a worried expression and then politely asks me to go into the back room. I join what looked like 100 Koreans and a miscellany of other potential personae non grata. A Frenchman is being noisily grilled by an immigration officer at a high desk. The officer looks like an ugly, acne-scarred version of Jim Carrey. The Frenchman looks preposterous. Fur-trimmed jeans, a leather patchwork shoulder bag, collar-length hair. Frankly, I wouldn't try to get into Legoland looking like that, let alone post-9/11 America. You say you're a philosophy teacher, the officer insinuates, in Grenoble, but you seem to spend an awful amount of time here. Yes, like I say, I have the girlfriend. Yeah, I know that, in Manhattan. And you're in and out of here like a yo-yo. There are stamps in here, he riffles the French passport, for every month of the last goddamn year. The Frenchman shrugs. She is my girlfriend. Hey, whatever. The officer is suddenly bored. He stamps the passport and beckons me up. Now, Mr. Self, are there some little things you maybe aren't telling us about yourself? Well, my voice drawls from deep in clubland. There are perhaps one or two trifling drug offenses. Ancient history, really. We're going to have to deport you. You cannot come in on a visa waiver with prior narcotics convictions. You'll have to go back to London and apply for a visa there. My heart sinks, then steadies. Look, officer, I say, would it make any difference if I told you that I was an American citizen? The Jim Carrey-alike scrutinizes me intently. What makes you think that? I tell him that my mother was a citizen, born in 1922 in Columbus, Ohio, and that she registered me at the U.S. Embassy in London when I was born. Carrey says he will check this information out and shoos me back to the bolted down seats. Over the next 2 hours, all the Koreans and some Africans with impressive psychratization scars are admitted to the land of the free. The only people left are me and a silently weeping German family, comprising late middle-aged parents and a grown-up daughter. Apparently, the paterfamilias failed to get an exit stamp in his passport when he departed in 1987. Jim Carrey and I have struck up an acquaintanceship. We suck mints together and listen to Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, played on the CD-ROM drive of his computer terminal. Finally, he beckons for me to follow him and leads me back through a warren of offices. I'm taking you back here, he confides, because we've decided to admit you, but we're going to deport the Germans. And, he pauses significantly, I don't want to upset them any more than necessary. In the back office sits an older, heavier-set man with a strict moustache and iron-filing hair. The stars and stripes limps on the flagpole by his desk. He looks up from studying my passport when Jim and I enter.
So, Mr. Self, he asks without preamble, what exactly do you think you are?
A dual citizen, I suppose. He breathes heavily.
Mr. Self, I have been an immigration officer for 35 years, and let me tell you something. You are either an apple or a pear.
He pauses, allowing this fructuous moment to dangle between us.
I don't care if you choose to live in London. I don't even mind if you travel on a British passport when you're abroad. But let me tell you this.
His voice begins to quaver with emotion.
When you come here to the United States of America, you are an American citizen.
I snap to attention. The battle hymn of the Republic swells in my inner ear as I deftly circle my covered wagon in front of the Lincoln Memorial, leap out, and march forward to receive the Pulitzer.
Sir, yes, sir,
I bark. On the way out, Jim Carrey passes me my British passport.
I don't even want to hold this.
His voice is also choked with patriotism.
Because it offends me to see you traveling on such a document.
Now, a few months later, I'm the proud possessor of an American passport, and to begin with, I felt pretty strange about it. To tell the truth, I've never felt my nationality define me any more than my shoe size. Actually, since my shoe size is 12, a good deal less. But since actualizing my Americanness, I've given a good deal of thought to whether I feel American or British or European or anything. Am I, in fact, a citizen of a vast Oceania which stretches from Brest-Litovsk to Honolulu? But on consideration, weighing up all the geopolitical, historical, and cultural factors, it's dawned on me that the possession of two passports means one thing and one thing alone. Shorter queues on embarkation either side of the Atlantic. I'm not an apple or a pear. I'm a banana skin glissading through immigration.
Will and I are going to talk for about 40 minutes or so, and then we're going to turn it over to you guys for a little bit, as Louise mentioned. And got the questions. So I wanted to start by asking you about the walk, the walk yesterday, mm-hmm. And then we'll elide into other walks, but the walk from LAX to Watts. Mm. What was that like? What time of day did you go, and how did you navigate? It seems to me that LAX is an easier airport to actually get to surface streets than, say, JFK, which you write about in the book, the difficulty of actually getting out of the Kennedy Airport complex.
Yeah, I mean, JFK is it's an empty quarter for the pedestrian. I had a kind of... Though, interestingly, the woman who worked on ground transportation at JFK, when I said I want to walk out of the airport, she kind of got it. She said, it's a quest. she had no idea how you could do it. But and you do, as far as I know. I mean, I came out at night, and I had to walk on elevated freeway for nearly half a mile. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody who wasn't foolhardy. But, LAX, you come out of the terminal and onto Century and walk for 12 miles. And that tells you a lot about LA immediately. There can be no, I've done quite a few of these airport walks, right. It has to be the only city in the world, probably, in which you could do that.
In which you could do what? Come out onto surface streets or walk for 12 miles?
Not come out onto surface streets, but come out onto surface streets, turn left, and just walk straight for 12 miles. That's got to be a unique characteristic of L.A. And brilliant for that. I mean, here immediately you're presented with the quiddity of a place. You know, what its essential quality is in that way.
Right.
I found it a very beautiful and haunting walk. I left it. Unfortunately, my flight was late in. One of your colleagues from the LA Times was meeting me, and we were hoping to get going by 11:30, in which case my plan was to go all the way to Watts and then swing into downtown. But unfortunately, it was dark by the time, or getting dark by the time I got to Watts.
Right. Now, I walk in LA a lot, and I always am sort of looked askance at. There's a famous Ray Bradbury story, which is based on his experience being stopped by cops on Wilshire Boulevard in the 50s for walking, because they couldn't figure out what exactly he was doing.
Mm.
You know. And I wonder, in terms of the difference of it, when you walk from, say, JFK, or if you walk from Heathrow, or if you walk from your home to Heathrow, or walk, you were saying backstage that you would walk from SeaTac into Seattle.
Mm.
You're walking through industrial areas or non-residential areas, so there's not a lot of street life in some quarters you're passing through. What's distinct about LA? It's a city you don't know well. So what sorts of messages come up? You know.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about walking is that even on a walk, which in terms of the greater Los Angeles area is a relatively short walk, I still learned more about the topography, sociology, and kind of history of LA than I've learned in 5 or 6 previous visits to the city that have been car-bound and defined by a human geography. You know, what my kind of practice of psychogeography is all about is decoupling physical from human geography, which I think goes back to the Situationists. So, you know, you actually get up past the old horse track. You do get up onto a rise where Figaro heads north from there, where you actually can see the mountains and you can see the dip back down to Playa del Rey, and you can get a feeling for what the landscape is like. Of course, over this, as you all know, is lain this humongous graticule, which is the LA sub parts, and they all have their own characteristic. They all have a different color scheme. They all have a different signage. And you have this strange phenomenon, which I think to a European is really odd, which is that the way in which, you know, poor districts of LA are congruent with wealthy districts. They wear, as it were, the mask of affluence in that way. So you have to look closely to see that these are distressed subdivisions, that these are knock-kneed houses. You have to kind of get a feel for it in that way. But it was, I found it a curiously beautiful walk, but then people often look askance at me.
No, I think that's a good point. One of the things that I first noticed that really struck me when I moved here was exactly what you're saying, that I couldn't read the city, having grown up in an eastern city, I couldn't read the city because it didn't make sense to me that a disadvantaged neighborhood or a poor neighborhood would have lawns and palm trees and private homes. That wasn't at all my experience. And it was almost like learning to read a new language in some way.
I think it is. And of course, you know, these districts that to a kind of somebody from London and England are mythic, like Compton or Watts, you know, where, and I think if you probably speak to Los Angelinos who are from up in the valley or from the north, they're not places that they would naturally consider going for a stroll in. Nonetheless, you know, to me appeared innocuous, actually, to walk through.
Now, I wanted to just sort of go and get some basic information, contextual information about psychogeography and the situation. So I wondered if you could sort of explain it generally to an audience. I'm assuming that not all of you are familiar with the concept. Is that right? So if you could sort of generally explain the concept. And then I'm also really interested in how your own sense of it differs from the Situationist's notion, which we can talk about.
Well, I mean, the term itself, psychogeography, was coined by Guy Debord, who was the kind of leading light of the Situationists, who were a tiny groupuscule of insufferably pretentious Marxists in 1950s Paris. And Debord's view was that he coined this term, the dérive, the drift through cities. I say insufferably pretentious. In fact, Debord's principal and indeed only work, The Society of the Spectacle, I think is an astonishing book, and I'd urge everybody to read it. It may be written in kind of pseudo-Hegelian sets of propositions, but in fact, it's really quite astonishingly prescient about the world that's come into being. But you know, one of the central theses of the Society of the Spectacle is that there is a kind of virtuality about what Debord fervently hoped was late capitalist society, but it's got a lot later now. And you know, his view really was that it was summed up by a graffito I once saw on a shopping mall in England, which just said, "Work, consume, die." And his view was that the modern city reflects that kind of ethos, and it reflects it to such a level that it's no longer a real place. You go to work, you make your money. And you are funneled into consumer experiences, you're funneled into entertainment, you're funneled home again. And the exigencies of time pressure and money pressure means that you can no longer occupy the city as a real place. You can only occupy this kind of virtualized city. And Debord and the Situationists, his solution to this was to... He grew up north of the Parc des Buttes Chaumont in a northern suburb of Paris, and they would buy a lot of bottles of cheap red wine, walk and totter along down through Paris getting drunk, and then collapse on the Ile de la Cité and sleep it off, thereby hopefully tearing down the capitalist hegemony. And it is kind of funny, and there's a rather brilliant biography of Debord as a good way into him by a man called Andrew Hussey called The Game of War. But, the problem for the Situationists was that a few years later, they kind of nearly did bring Paris crashing down. I mean, he was really the kind of avatar of the Événement in 68. So... he's the place to start on all this. After that, really, I think psychogeography, and of course, Debord himself hadn't coined anything original. I mean, the idea in French culture of the flâneur or the boulevardier, of the person who moves through the city alive to experience that is out of the ordinary, is, you know, a very deep tradition. And it's present in English letters as well. I mean, I think probably Thomas de Quincey is the best example in his essay, Anne of Oxford Street, and that kind of thing about a way of regarding the city. So you can see really psychogeography's roots going back to the Romantic movement as a sort of bastard love child of Romanticism, really. But if you then come forward, it's not a field in any meaningful sense. You can't say, you know, you've got psychogeography the way you have ecology or the way you have local history or the way you have topography. It's rather, I view it as a practice in itself. It's something you do rather than something you study. And it has migrated quite successfully across the channel, where probably its two greatest contemporary English exponents are on the one hand Peter Ackroyd, and on the other hand a writer called Ian Sinclair, who people may be less familiar with. But Ian is really the walking psychogeographer par excellence, and he tends to view cities, though he's very interested in things like ley lines. He's very interested in the idea that cities contain mystic thoroughfares that are, again, you know, once you've got rid of all of this business of work, consume, die, you can begin to apprehend the city through these different and old ways.
When you say mystic thoroughfare, I wonder, what does that mean? Are we talking about an actual physical thoroughfare, or are we talking about something more along the lines of a kind of psychic songline, for want of a better
phrase. I think psychic songline's fine. I mean, I think he does believe that the city aligns itself. I mean, this is the other. This is when psychogeography slides towards the psycho end of things, in the sense that not in the way you're thinking, but more in the sense that both Aykroyd and Sinclair view the city itself as having a psyche. I don't think that's that preposterous an idea. If you read a book like Aykroyd's London, the biography, you know, he views London as this 2 millennia-old organism, a mind, really, in its own right. And, you know, he looks at districts of London and as a 19th-century phrenologist might feel the bumps on somebody's head and say, you know, what is the character of this person? You know, so that there are quarters of a city that have a character that imposes itself on the inhabitants that is something that they kind of can't shake off. And I would imagine that's as true for LA as it is for London, that there are parts of the city, it doesn't matter whether you go in and knock them down and build strip malls or redevelopment, put up condos or whatever, that the personality of that district will reassert itself.
And you talk about, in the book, you actually talk about a city like Rome, where that 2,000-year-old organism is right in front of you because of the 2,000-year-old buildings that are still in use in some cases and that, you know, that are there, that you see the, you know, whatever, the Pantheon or the, you know, remains of the Forum or the Colosseum. And so that psyche becomes physicalized in some sense.
Mm. I mean, Rome, I mean, I'd be fascinated to discover what kind of psychogeography is being done in Rome. I mean, it seems to me it's a city that would resist attempts to grapple with it psychically in that way, so dense and so layered is its history. But I mean, in a sense, it's kind of not true. London bigs itself up as a 2,000-year-old city, but the reality is it's a Victorian city. I mean, that's what the bulk of it is.
Now, one of the things about this has to do with this sort of dichotomy between orienting and disorienting oneself. I'm curious about that. In some ways, it's sort of an inverse. You disorient as a way of orienting or as a way of reorienting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some people, I mean, if you go on the web and you look at, there are psychogeography groups. I mean, personally, I tend to find it a solitary activity. But people do kind of bond together and try and constructively disorient themselves within the city. You know, again, going back to Debord, they're aiming to drop out of this kind of work-consume-die matrix and view. So they develop an algorithm or they throw a dice and decide only to move across the city according to kind of random movements. That's not really my thing. I mean, I can see some validity in it, but it seems a little kind of pretentious to me, almost.
Or contrived, in a way.
Or
right?
Contrived.
There are also those people who will take the map of one city and overlay it onto the grid of another city and then navigate the one city by the street structure of the first city, if that makes any sense.
Well, you know, in London, and I'm sure it's true here, I mean, a lot of cab drivers, of course, are far more familiar with other cities than they are with the city they're actually driving in. I'm always sitting with cabbies who I know fine well. I think, is he seeing Lagos as he turns this corner, you know? Or then we have this even more bizarre phenomenon. I don't know if it's quite so prevalent here, where now a lot of the cab drivers, not the licensed cab drivers who have to do this astonishing thing, the knowledge in London, where they have to know the names of every street, but the minicab drivers all drive on sat-nav, and they can get a job immediately. So they don't actually know where they are at all. I mean, that's the most at all. I mean, I live about a mile away from the district of Chelsea in London, and I've got into a cab with a driver who didn't know or indeed hadn't heard of Chelsea. So you kind of, but I don't really practice that kind of disorientation. I'm interested in the way in which, and I think the airport walks come out of this. It's not that I'm some kind of Luddite who's trying to assault all systems of travel, though I'm getting increasingly Luddite, I have to say, as I get older. It's more that I'm fascinated by, for a start, I think that there's an experience of the sublime to be had in air travel.
but that all of modern air travel is directed towards making it a dull experience. You know, they don't want everybody to go through security, get into the gate, and be jizzed up at being about. Because I don't know how anybody else feels, but I still think that jet air travel is unquestionably the strangest phenomenon, technological phenomenon in my life. I mean, it beats hell out of anything to do with computers. I mean, it is an enormous and you know. And as I get older, I find it stranger, even though I grew up.
To me, it's almost magical, the idea that you can be in London, say, and 12 hours later you could be in Los Angeles. It's a magical experience.
It's a magical experience, but by walking out of the airport, you also experience it, the sublime aspect of it. I mean, it was interesting walking up Century. I was on the flight path yesterday, so I had this thing of flying in from Seattle, coming into land along Century, and then walking out with plane after plane and really appreciating the heft, the weight, and the power of these aircraft as they come in overhead. But more than that, it's a question always for me about scale. Here you have this means of transport that takes you at 500 miles an hour through the sky at 30,000 feet, and then suddenly you're at ground level moving at 3 miles an hour. And suddenly it is astonishing that I'm sure everybody in this room flies. You get these, I'm always reminded of the 19th century painter John Martin, who did these astonishing paintings like The Plains of Heaven, with kind of impossibilist 80-mile horizons, with little plumes of spindrift in the distance. There were in fact thousands of angels. And if these guys could have seen what we see on an average jet flight, they would have been absolutely staggered, and yet we sit there, you know, the people get on the plane and they're fiddling with the you know, little, they're watching a fag, you know, cigarette packet size screen in the back of the person's head in front of them, or they're playing Donkey Kong on their, you know, I want to shake these people and say this is one of the most extreme. And but of course I'm prey to that ennui as well. After a while I stopped looking out at this astonishing cloudscape and I retreated to my micro world. But I'm by walking from the airport, I reappropriate the strangeness of flight itself. By walking from the airport, I instantly ground myself in the most significant way, and I stop living in this dispersed human geography, these kind of micro environments that are joined up by air travel. I mean, there must be people, we all do it, you know, we go on vacation to the same place every year. We love it in wherever it is, Okefenokee or Bongo Bongo Land. The people there really know us, and they love us too. We've been going back for 25 years, but you know nothing in between, and you don't even know where Bongo Bongo Land really is. You know, it's just a little grid of there's the Bongo Bongo Hotel and the gift shop you always go to and whatever it is. You know, and it's really trying to hit against that disorientation that I've taken to walking from the airport.
So that's how, because the book opens with an extended piece that's about a walk from London to New York, and in the middle of the walk, of course, is a long airplane ride. And it's a curious construction, and that's how the plane ride fits into the walk.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is that it works. Yeah. I mean, I begin to sound slightly crazy at this point, and people leave, but, you know, somebody just has, but... You know, mitochondrial Eve, stepping out away from the Rift Valley, lived in an ambulatory world 5 million years ago. And up until 1840, when Stevenson's rocket took its first smooth progress, all forms of human travel were aeotechnic. They were defined by the human body's muscles itself. You know, even if not directly, then indirectly through a horse or through an animal of some kind. Only our even sailing would still give you a workout. It's only with the arrival of the train, you know, a mere 160 years ago, that all of this changes, that we stop having a physical apprehension of space when we travel. So when I walked to New York, I walked from my house in central London to Heathrow, flew to JFK, and then walked from JFK into Manhattan. When I walked into my hotel on the Lower East Side, I felt like I'd walked the whole way. Because my body told me that that's what I'd been doing. I'd been walking for 2 days. And I had this uncanny sensation that Long Island had rammed into the Thames estuary, and these two had become a continuous landmass through this strange kind of psychic tectonic movement. It really, really worked. It's the most uncanny sensation.
The other thing that's interesting to me is that you end up disorienting. It's not just about disorienting yourself. There's an anecdote in here where you talk about going to a meeting and the guy you're meeting with says, you know, how was it to come here? You say, fine. How long did it take you? And you say, 10 hours. And all of a sudden, his face looks like he's thinking, well, if it took you 10 hours to get here, then does the meeting have to last for 20 hours?
Or 2 weeks. Well, I mean, it is. You only have to go back to Jane Austen novels where, you know, I can't remember the name of the you know, these young ladies will go to stay at somebody's house, and one of them will get a sniffle, and they'll have to stay for a fortnight.
Right.
You know, even though it's only like 7 miles away from their home. You know, and that's the way things were. You know, the pace of one's ability to travel defined social interaction in that way as well. And if you walk, you know, on that occasion, I'd walked 22 miles to a meeting. I think the guy thought I was going to ask that the meeting went on for a fortnight or so before I let him go. And you know, it goes back to that graffito, to work, consume, die. You know, I mean, I'm as prey to these pressures as anybody else, but this is my way of striking against them. There's also this strange phenomenon with walking. I live now the south of England is probably as densely inhabited as the greater Los Angeles area. I mean, it is, England as a whole is the second most densely populated country in the world. There are 750 people for every square mile. But I have this strange phenomenon where I walk more or less every year now for 100 miles directly out of London from my house. And I did it. I walked to the south coast a couple of years ago, and I didn't see anybody for 2 days. I didn't see a soul. When I got to a road, there were enormous SUVs powering past, you know, and somebody would be frenziedly driving little Tinkerbell to her pony club. But actually, in the country, there was nobody at all. So, and I had this strange sensation that I was some sort of Viet Cong insurgent tunneling through rural England.
Yeah, I've had that experience in the Southwest here where there are just vast tracts of endless hundreds of miles with nothing.
Mm.
You know, but from living in the cities or living on the coast, you're used to that same kind of density, and you forget that both what the size of the continent is if you travel it over land as opposed to in the air.
Yeah, but I mean, this is in a huge... I mean, the comparable thing is actually walking from LAX to Watts, because real pedestrians, i.e. not people who were just walking from a convenience store to their car or walk... I don't think I passed anybody.
Right.
In a sense, I didn't meet anybody who was within my mode at all the whole way there. So it was a kind of empty world for me in that way.
Now, you don't... In the book, excuse me, a lot of the pieces don't deal with walking or don't deal exclusively with walking. They deal with other modes of transportation or travel or just the experience of being in different environments. I mean, there's a great piece about sort of dragging your kids to the suburbs to sort of disorient them, and watching your oldest son be as miserable and hate the conformity of the suburbs in exactly the way that you did at his age. And you watch him, it's almost a converse thing, right? Rather than being calm in the suburbs, he gets tense, and it's only when you get on the train back to the city that you watch him calm down.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that notion, too, about sort of adapting these ideas to kind of the practicality of life. As you say, you're not immune from the work, consume, die ethos. So how does psychogeography work when you're not walking? Or how does it change the notion of psychogeography to be doing it through vehicular motion as opposed to pedestrian motion?
Well, you know, even taking public transport helps to break things down, because it requires a further level of orientation. You know, and it requires a human scale to enter into I mean, I've been in LA for a couple of days now, and it looks like I may get out of here without setting foot in a car, which would be a strange thing to do in Los Angeles.
Worth an essay in and of
And I think we can all practice it. I mean, it is, I've, as I said, been traveling around North America a lot over the years, usually on author tours. And this time, I've not taken cabs. You know, when you hire a cab, you're not actually hiring a car. You're hiring a driver's brain. And my experience of getting into cabs is that I immediately stop thinking about where I am because I've employed somebody to think about it for me. And I just don't bother to think about where I am anymore. Even the act of going down and taking the bus out to the airport or the subway changes that, and you start orienting yourself in a new way. Because, of course, everybody can't walk everywhere. It's just not going to work out. I mean, the president can walk everywhere and chew gum at the same time, as far as I'm aware.
There's that, too. But it's because you become the active agent of your own sort of interaction or movement.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds kind of trivial in a way, but it's non-trivial to me. I mean, I do all sorts of bizarre things at a personal level to try and hit against this, vary my means of transport. You know, I have a folding bicycle I'm known to take with me and take odd journeys that are counterintuitive in various ways.
Like what kind? We wonder if you can elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, you know, recently in England, I had to give a seminar at Manchester University. So I took the train to Liverpool and then cycled along the Manchester Ship Canal, which is an incredibly famous. It's now disused, of course, but it was the absolute, you know, kind of natal channel of the Industrial Revolution. This was what made it possible for the manufacturers of Manchester to get out to the British colonies and for the raw stuff to come in. So that, you know, that's a kind of very strange and powerful journey to take in this post-industrial landscape and a way of coming upon these two cities that's different.
Now, one of the things that I find really interesting is that you developed these pieces as part of a column that you write for the Independent, which is a newspaper in England. Are you still writing the column?
Yes, I filed one last night.
And, you know, as a newspaper editor, I have to ask, how did you sell this? How did you convince them to let you do this? This is a great idea, but it seems to me that certainly American newspapers are so in such a kind of state of crisis that I think they'd be reluctant to allow this kind of amorphous, indefinable type of column to take root.
Yeah, that may be true. I mean, I've written a couple of little psychogeographic pieces for papers here that cover some of these themes, which just leads me to, I mean, another kind of, how did I get them to take it on? I don't know. I mean, it existed beforehand in a stranger form, which I wrote a column which Ralph Steadman worked with me on for, I never say he illustrates it, he's far too grand to be an illustrator, he has issues with that, for the British Airways Flight magazine, and most environmentally unsound this, I would take a short-haul flight within the British Isles, take a walk and then fly back again the same day. So that was the kind of genesis of this column originally. And then I just pitched it to them and they took it on.
How does it? How do you see it relating or connecting to your fiction? It seems to me that much of your fiction, in a different way, deals with disorientation. I mean, Cock and Bull being an obvious example, where a guy grows a vagina and a woman grows a penis. I mean, that in some ways is a kind of psychic disorientation in a related way to the kind of physical disorientation of this kind of work.
Yeah. I'm all about disorientation. But interestingly, I'm all about place as well. So I that's one possible axis on which you can look at my work overall, I suppose. I mean, when the last novel, The Book of Dave, is probably my most placey book in that way. It's most preoccupied with trying to cite characters within a landscape and really looking at the phenomenon of the urban scape in a different way. You know, in London at the moment, we're very preoccupied by the fact that if climate change continues the way it very much seems to be, the city's actually going to be flooded within, you know, a few decades. I mean, unquestionably, I mean, it already would have been flooded several times. I mean, the Thames barrier has been raised more times in the last 2 years to prevent London flooding than it was in the first 20 years of its existence. So this is a looming problem. And this really got me thinking about who it is who retains the idea of the city. You know, if these cities are going to go underwater, if they're going to be destroyed in some way, who is it? And as I was saying before, we have this bizarre phenomenon in London that the licensed London cab drivers in the famous black cabs are required to know the name of every single street and public building within a 6 mile radius of Charing Cross. It's an unprecedented bit of information and kind of bit of neural mapping to be involved in. And in fact, there's a neuroscientist at University College in London who's placed cabbies in positron emission tomography machines and discovered that the posterior hippocampus of the London cabbie is bigger than that of normal people. So these guys and guyesses are in fact driving around with bigger brains because they hold this information. So it was a hop and a skip to the idea of, you know, what if a London cabbie were to write a kind of Jeremiad against the contemporary world that would then he would bury and would be unearthed hundreds of years in the future when London's been flooded and would become the Bible of a future society, as well as containing fragments of this astonishing knowledge of the cityscape so that they'd start rebuilding the city. So that's there you have it. There's extreme orientation and extreme disorientation. And I think, you know, there are writers of place and there are writers who aren't of place. I mean, Nabokov at his celebrated lectures at Cornell in 56, you know, he would get up before an audience and if he was lecturing on Austin's Mansfield Park, he'd draw the floor plan of the house. If he was lecturing on Proust, he would draw the two ways at Combray, he'd draw a map of it. You know, so I think as readers, we have the experience of reading a novel that's set in a place, and we know whether or not the writer knows what they're writing about. You know it intuitively, even if you've never been there. You know, there is an, you know, so it's almost as if we can, there's some sense we have for gauging the spatial awareness of the writer because it's present there in the virtual world that the writer's describing. And just as we've all had the experience of opening a book and reading a book that's allegedly set in a place and knowing that the writer is bullshitting in some way. They don't know what they're about. So I think place is important in that way for novels.
So to come back to the essays, many of them are about places you know. Many of them are about places you don't know. What's the difference, both in terms of the psychogeographic experience and also in terms of trying to write about it, trying to write about a place that you've dropped into for a brief period of time, as opposed to, say, writing about London, which is a city that you feel in your blood?
Maybe I should read one of the other pieces about somewhere I don't know, and that'll try. Maybe I'll do that.
Sao Paulo was, to adopt an idiom, way too much. The ride in from the airport through asteroid belts of the favelas and then the planetary scale of the urban mass itself. Sitting in a restaurant atop the highest building in the city, I could see what looked like a snaggle of teeth on the horizon some 20 miles away. But when I scrutinized them carefully, I saw that they too were equally vast edifices. The comprehension gap was as disorienting as the culture shock. In my 4-star hotel, I couldn't find one staff member who spoke more than rudimentary English or French. If you wanted to get anywhere here, you needed Portuguese or German. I couldn't get my plastic to work in the cash machines, so one afternoon I set out to find a bank where I could draw some money. I walked and I walked. As well as being illimitable, Sao Paulo seemed to have little or no comprehensible street plan. It was like an unholy miscegenation between London and Los Angeles. Mighty metropolises, grey and golden and exhaust-stained, humping at the place of dead roads. In some dusty square, metal-tortured boulevard or another, I fell in with an elderly German who spoke sinisterly good English. I say sinisterly because everything about him was sinister to my paranoiac mind. What was he doing here? Why did he talk about himself so circumspectly, but want to know all about me? I could almost visualize the death's head badges of the SS on his faded Hawaiian shirt. The minibar in the hotel was no help. It was called the self bar. So I took it personally and downed the lot. The scotches, the vodkas, the gins, and the Amazonian armpit aguardientes. Then I howled down the lift shaft. My Brazilian translator, the redoubtable Hamilton dos Santos, seeing the state I was getting into, suggested a little R&R in Rio. I flew there on a Varig flight for which there was no internal security. This was 10 years ago, and perhaps things have changed since. But in those days, the explanation Brazilians gave me for the lack of metal detectors at their airports was that everyone insisted on packing guns. It was drizzling in Rio when I arrived, and the scuzzy grey shanty towns on the surrounding peaks threatened to topple onto Copacabana. In place of the sparkling strand of my imagination, crowded with promenading steatopus lovelies, their café au lait buttocks cloven by itsy-bitsy G-strings, I found instead three men in anoraks fishing the angry Atlantic while seated on collapsible stools. Shit, I admonished myself. I need never have left East Finchley after all. If Sao Paulo was threatening, Rio was terrifying. But I had nothing to read, which is the most frightening thing of all when abroad. I went out with my money in my sock to find an English language bookshop and couldn't anywhere. Eventually, I discovered one on a bus ride away at a shopping mall in an outer suburb. They had three shelves of airport dross and one copy of William L. Shearer's magisterial The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I snapped it up. I spent the next week snuggled up to the tiny zinc-topped bar of the tiny cafe opposite my hotel, assiduously working my way through Shearer. In the scary atmosphere of Rio, the horrors perpetrated by the Nazis seemed almost gemütlich. I'd also sensibly switched to beer. Gradually, day by day, I felt the chaotic life around me begin to assume some kind of coherence. I noticed that the street urchins, the hawkers, the washerwomen, the service workers for the skyscraper hotels lining the beach, the whole population of this quarter, in fact, all knew one another and looked out for each other. Every individual had its niche in the living reef, and if a new creature came into the area, its character and potential to be a threat was instantly noted. Far from being a soulless adjunct to the dubious delights of Copacabana in this, the off-season, I could appreciate the tightly knit community I found myself in. On the final night I spent in Rio, I broached the language barrier and fell in with a couple of good-time girls. I say girls advisedly because although they looked younger than me, such were the concertina demographics of Brazil that one of them turned out to be a grandmother. Anyway, by a combination of signs and pidgin English, I managed to convey to these two the extent of my sociological observations of Copacabana. Oh, yes, Vittoria replied. We know everyone here, and if anyone new comes and we don't know their name, they get given a nickname so we can easily identify them. So, I asked, not a little incurious, have I got a nickname? Of course. She gestured at the prominent swastika on the cover of my Shearer. We call you Hitler.
So what you're saying is that eventually, just through observation, you begin to find your place there. I mean, that, what's interesting about that piece is the way that you start out as a complete alien in every way and then gradually kind of make a place for yourself and figure out what the territory is.
Kind of. I mean, actually, that would be overstating it. I don't think I'm saying that, David. Actually, what I'm saying is that I'm even more profoundly disorientated at the end. And I think a lot of travel writing is, I think there are some brilliant travel writers, and don't get me wrong, but a lot of it is kind of travel porn. Mm-hmm. It's for people to sit at home kind of masturbating about places that they might go to if they ever could be bothered to get out of their chair and actually get to the airport. And there's another kind of travel writing that is really deeply bogus, and it's about conveying to people how to maintain themselves within the society of the spectacle but move to another location.
Right.
So it provides a sense of false orientation. And I suppose what I'm trying to do in little pieces like that is to say how profoundly disorientating other places can be and can continue to be. You know, even if you stay there for a while and even if you think you're there, your nickname is Hitler. And what could be more disorientating than that? I mean, what does it mean of a society that they have given you the nickname Hitler? I think that's...
Right. All right. Well, I think I'm going to turn it over to questions from the floor at this point. So, Justin is there with the microphone. If you guys raise your hand, and he will come and bring the microphone around. Oh, and I'll choose. Yes. So, raise your hand.
I've lived in 27 countries, and I do exactly what you do because the energy of the urban environment hits me very hard, not the non-urban environment. And so I walk till I feel the pulse of where I am. The one city I never, and I work there, the one city that I never could feel the pulse, I felt like I was in the mouth of a dragon, was San Paulo. And I was so surprised when you said that, and I can't figure out what it was. I walked till I dropped.
That's not really a question, is it?
But yeah, I want to know what you said. This almost the same thing.
I'm glad that such a veteran expatriate as you should confirm that impression of it. Especially since I was completely off my tits, whereas you probably weren't. But it is a very, very strange city, and I was there this year again, and it hadn't got any more pedestrian in the time I'd been away.
You know, you've talked a lot about urban wanderings, and it seems like you're taking these kind of topographical calisthenics to open yourself up as a writer to a sense of disorientation or satori, even, in terms of being disconnected and connected at the same time. And I'm wondering how that contrasts with, I believe that when you write, I've read in the past that you sometimes go away to a cottage and write somewhere in a rural idyll. I wondered how your brain, your sense of wanting to find this kind of disconnected satori, which will give you insight, functions in a more rural idea, which is what you said earlier on, the sublime. Because there seem to me to be very different vibes between an urban vibration and a rural one. And I wondered if that was any distinction that you make.
Yeah, I mean, it is a distinction. But of course, you'll be familiar with the fact that you know, the best way of thinking of the British Isles is to think of it as an entire nation of secondary reforestation on the eastern seaboard. You know, so in other words, agriculture is not economically viable in the British Isles, so it's not really a proper rural environment. Not only that, it's been inhabited, you know, for a very, very long period. In fact, the dates for human habitation are going back and back and back at the moment, and back nearly to a million years of human habitation in the British Isles. And it's an intensely humanly shaped landscape. So, you know, in the sense that there's wilderness in North America, it just doesn't exist in the British Isles. And I'm sensible of that. I think, you know, one of the places that I always used to go and write, I've done it less so in recent years, is the Orkney Islands off the north coast of Scotland. Well, this place was the most, after Salisbury Plain, was the most densely inhabited place in the British Isles, 3,500 BC. I mean, there are intact Stone Age villages there with the dressers, with little stone vessels on them. So it's not a wild landscape in a very, very important way. I haven't really answered your question. For me, the writing and the business of going away to write is almost about the reverse thing. I find it easier to actualize the places I write about when I'm not in them to some extent. And I think a lot of writers have that experience, that it's kind of... I mean, for example, George Orwell wrote 1984 on the Hebridean island of Jura, and I was at the house he wrote it in, actually, this year. And I think of all his books, it's the most... Even though it's set in a future dystopia, it's very much set in London of the 1940s and a very, very carefully realised, if banjaxed, London of the 1940s. So it's more about that for me. It's more about the way in which removal into the rural helps me to realise the urban more fully. And the kind of stuff about being... I mean, I love what passes for countryside in that neck of the woods, but that kind of is R&R for me. It's not really... work.
This gentleman over here.
So I was wondering about, well, I've heard of like the meditative quality of walking, just kind of the repetitiveness. So I have two questions. One is when you're, I assume you do it alone mostly, and I was wondering kind of about your thoughts about kind of like the spiritual aspect of these like really long walks, these journeys or whatever. And then if you've walked with another person and how the kind of different experiences compare, like, you know, with a companion versus alone. So that's one question. Then the second question is, do your walks are they always contained within the frame of a day? Like, have you gone on a walk where you kind of are still outside sort of, you know, overnight and continue walking into the next day? And so I guess kind of like, what's your longest walk or whatever?
Okay. I mean, it sort of relates to what you were talking about as well. I mean, I do long rural walks as well. I do this walk, I mean, this sort of part of my obsession with knowing where I am is that I'm walking 100 miles out of London every year along cardinal lines of the compass. Because it seems to me the most clear phenomenon, the clearest way that the urban dweller disregards where they are is by leapfrogging over the hinterland of cities. Everybody goes, you know, up to the mountains to ski, or they go down to the ocean, but nobody wants to go to Riverside, though we were talking about... I think Louise was saying that a guy outside the library asked her how to walk to Riverside. I was just immediately thinking, yeah, I've got to walk to Riverside. I mean, people don't... So I do this thing, and Cyril Connolly, the English writer and critic, said no city should be so large that a man can't walk out of it in a morning. Well, you guys and I live in cities that are way too big for that. And part of this business of reclamation for me is walking out of cities. So those walks will be 3 and 4 days, 5 days sometimes. And I like high mileages, and I like the way that if you walk really over 30 miles in a day, you really start to apprehend. Your mind kind of sinks into the topography itself, into the landscape. That's the point at which the natural shape of the land completely overtakes the human presence for me, and I start thinking in terms of, you know, ranges of hills and river valleys and things like that. I'm no longer thinking about buildings, really, and about the built environment in that way. And that is, in as much as I'm open to the mystical, that is the Sartori for me, that absorption into the land. And yes, of course, you're right. I mean, it is a meditative act, the movement of legs. You know, we walk in a 4-4 rhythm. We walk like somebody spinning a prayer wheel or reciting a mantra. And eventually... I think what you find when you walk alone, if you walk for long periods of time, is, you know, the Germans have a great word for it, and I can't remember the German word, but it translates as the earworm. And, you know, for the first 5, 10, 15 miles, you may have a bad earworm. You know, you may have a kind of two lines, a couplet from a pop song you hated the first time round that fastens on your brain. And you're going, you know, itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini for like 3 hours, and you can't shift it, or else you're remembering what that guy said to you at that party in 1983, and how could they say that to you? But eventually that kind of does start to fall away, and you're left. You know, people say to me often, do you walk in order to get ideas? And on the contrary, I walk in order not to have ideas. You know, that's what I spend most of my time sitting in a room trying to have ideas, and I really want to get away from it. And that is the Sartori, in as much as there is one. And, you know, to be blunt, the companion is inimical to that. You know, another psyche along with you, and then it's about something else. It's about a relationship. It's about being together. It becomes very external. It doesn't. You've got no possibility of losing ego in that situation. But that's fine. It's just a different thing.
In the back. Well, yeah.
Both the automobile and the airplane were supposed to be inventions that shortened distances for people and allowed people to travel quickly and much more efficiently. And I get the same sense of wonder on an airplane as you described, like the oh my God, I can't believe I'm in the air thing. But it seems to me that what you're saying is kind of, well, I guess my question is, do you feel like the invention or at least the prevalence of the automobile has had a detrimental impact on society and people? And if so, how does that jive with the magic and the awe that we view jet travel with?
Okay, well, we're agreed about this magic and this awe around jet travel, which is, we're sitting here, David's subscribed to it, you subscribe to it. We know at a rational level, and we can maintain that awe for some of the time when we're flying, but everything conspires to make it dull, ultimately. You know, people don't come, nobody's going to call you up and say, I'm flying to Europe tomorrow and I don't care about Europe, but the flight will be incredible. You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, it's not going to be that way around. So, you know, the way in which our culture has gone to work for all sorts of reasons, quite complex reasons on air travel to make it dull, has affected us. We're already there. With cars, I think it's even gone beyond that. I personally think that a lot of people have addiction issues around cars because they exhibit all of the pathology of addicts to alcohol or drugs or anything like that. They're in denial about it for a start, but my car is useful to me. I couldn't operate without my car. They think that their car makes them free. You know, they think where in fact it confines them. And they spend a lot of their life, they work to maintain their car habit, which they are, you know, they protect their supply of car, you know. All of these things go on with car, with a car addiction. And people get very angry if you have a kind of confrontation, you gather their relatives together and confront them about their car issues, they get very, very angry with you. I mean, take a city like Los Angeles, where there is no let or hindrance to a good public transport rail system, and it's taken years and years and years to get anywhere near it happening, and it's going to be too little too late, let's face it. And there you have the evidence of a kind of car addiction society in denial of it. But listen, I'm not dissing you guys. In England, it's as bad, if not worse. I mean, it is completely crazy. I mean, and really the whole of the south of England now is very, in my mind, exactly like the greater LA area. So that's my kind of view of it. I mean, don't get me wrong, I've got a car myself. It's not that I'm immune to the idea of the car or to seeing that, but I think that it has become really pathological, actually. I mean, and look at it in connection with oil, for example. the kind of the vicious synergy that exists between car addiction and the pursuit of oil and how that's affected the world.
Two more? Okay. This gentleman, wait. Okay. We'll give it this gentleman and then the gentleman right behind you.
You mentioned a folding bike.
Mm.
How does travel by bicycle change your experience, your perception of things? Especially if you're traveling the same, going to the same place via different means.
Bicycle's good, but feet are better. Bicycle is... It's obviously aerotechnic, but because of the smoothness of the movement and because of our deep-seated car problems, it's very hard for us to not view the bicycle as a kind of crap car. a slow car. I mean, I love bicycle. That's my main means of transport in London. That's how I get around. And it's great to see in LA. I have what's called a fixed wheel bike, which you'll see all the couriers riding around Los Angeles. And they're hardcore. I mean, you can't freewheel on it at all. So you're in a one-to-one gearing with topography. You have to feel every movement through your legs. And these guys don't even have brakes, I notice, which is serious. You know, somebody said to me when I got one of these fixed wheel bikes, they said, "You have got a front brake at least, haven't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I have actually." And he said, "That's good, because without it, you'd have the life expectancy of a Battle of Britain fighter pilot." You know. So I love bikes. I love the aesthetics of them. They're kinetic machines in that way. They're great machines, but it's not as good as foot. Not as good.
And I'm wondering about your relationship to maps. Do you start walking with a map, like the map of the area, or do you walk without a map and build it in your head?
Good question. I mean, I'm not a kind of map nerd who has a vast collection of maps. And, you know, what David was mentioning before, this idea of laying one map over another. I don't, you know, there's a famous situationist text called "The Map Is Not the Territory." And though I always like the Stephen Wright gag, the comedian who said, you know, "I've got a map of the United States, its actual size." last year, instead of going for a vacation, I folded it. Which kind of sums up that whole kind of relationship. It's difficult in this line of practice not to become very preoccupied by maps. You have to restrain yourself and buy... you know, what it is to represent a place in a map form. I can see you share some of these issues. of course, I always have a map. You got to have a map. I couldn't, the idea of walking with GPS, I'm going to do it one time to see what it's like, but I mean, that just seems to me kind of mad and deranged, but that's because, you know, we're not to the manner born in that way. I'm sure for younger people that would just come quite naturally to them. No, I mean, part of the thrill is the continuous calibration of orientation that a map provides, whether you're in an urban context or you're in a rural area. I think that's part of the fun. And it's actually part of the Sartori, I think, because the continual looking from the landscape to the map means that you're no longer thinking in a reflectively self-conscious way. You're just, it's almost as if the human brain, getting back to this hunter-gatherer stuff, a lot of our brain must have been used up solely by issues of orientation for such a long time. It's like having the kind of primitive limbic system, that if you start really getting into where you are again, then all the rest of the yada yada starts to die away. Not as good as yours, but I mean, it's okay, yeah. I mean, I it's okay. Thank you. Thank you for asking.
All right, well, thank you all very much. There'll be a book signing out in the lobby.
Thank you.
Thank you, Will.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.